This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Kia ora tātou and welcome along to episode 5 of Aratoi On Air with me, your host Sean Norling, and my colleague Amy Tawa.
Kia ora everyone, welcome. Hi, what's up, Sean?
Oh, a couple of interviews this week. I had the absolute pleasure of talking to 3 out of the 4 wahine from the Matāho Collective, Erina Arapere Baker, Bridget Rewete, and Dr. Terry Te Tau. And I talked to them about their installation at the Dunedin Public Art Gallery, Hotamiro. That's a large-scale piece on the wall there as part of the Dunedin Public Art Gallery Aotearoa Visiting Artist Program, supported by Creative New Zealand. So yeah, a really cool chat with them. I also talked to Adelaide Dunn down at the University School of Performing Arts and Radio 1, 91 FM, and a producer and musician of some note. Talked to them about the role they play in those two institutions down there in the North End. Also talked to them about a range of topics, women in the music industry, synesthesia, all sorts of things. So a really interesting conversation with Adelaide Dunn, rhymes with fun. Yeah, so those two interviews in the cart this week. I want to thank Otago Access Radio for assisting us in bringing these conversations to you, the listener. Check us out online. What are our handles on social media?
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram. Our handle is at Aratoi Otiputi. You can also get in touch with us via email aratoi@dcc.govt.nz. Now, sit tight, get warm and cozy, and let's go.
I'm interested to know, given your work in a collective, but you all still are strong individual artists, what you've learnt from one another.
I think for me, in terms of the collective, within that collective space, it's like, go big or go home. In that space, I feel way braver to tackle kaupapa and materials and scale that is way beyond what I would consider even thinking about in my individual practice. So it's that kind of confidence, I think. Confidence in myself from being able to work together to problem solve and make big things that are physically big but also conceptually and, you know, kaupapa wise.
I guess for me, I've learnt that along the lines of what Bridget was saying about the can tackle big things but also that, like, not to scrutinise what you're doing in your own practice as opposed to what's happening within Matāho and being a mum and also an educator and all the different hats we wear. It's been really nice to have this consistent relationship and mahi doing this at times when, say, I haven't been able to make new work on my own, but Matāho's been ticking over, and then we say finish a project and there's a bit of time to go on and do something else and think about my students and what they're doing and all that type of thing. So yeah, the way it fits in, that we can make it fit into our lives and make it work. And I don't really know how. There's that idea of just adding it to the list of many things that we do.
I think for me, because this has been such a long-term thing for us, that we've been part of each other's lives for, you know, in the sense of Matāho Collective working together around 13 years now. Yeah. And so we've changed a lot as individuals over that time, and we've experienced different things within our lives, and we've all seen each other experiencing those different things. We've each needed different things at different periods. And there's something about the process that we've kind of established in the way that we work on projects that's really consistent and reliable, sort of what Edina was saying. When there's sticking points or things that are just a little bit hard, there's a kind of confidence that over time it'll work out And, you know, if there's something that we're kind of unsure about, or, you know, some of us are thinking, oh, that's, I'm not sure how that's working, it, through wānanga, it does come unstuck and it does kind of work itself out. So having confidence in that process of the four of us together, because it's kind of like the space that exists between the four of us. It's not really us as individuals so much, but we do know what each other needs, I think, and we can really trust and rely on that. And that changes too, depending on what's happening in our lives. Yeah.
You've spoken about the importance of working in a kind of wānaka kind of way. How? But you're all living in different parts of the country. How often do you get together and learn with each other?
It's really project by project. We try not to take on too many projects. Like at the moment, we're hoping that there's one major project at a time. Sometimes, some years it's been more than that, and that we know that can become a bit much. And they're often in different regions and different locations. We don't have one single studio space, but we definitely get together and work on admin and things one day a week, as well as would get together if we're working on a project that's coming up once every month or two somewhere in the country. Yeah.
Are you jumping on the Zooms kind of on, yeah, a, on a regular basis?
Yeah,
kind
definitely
of thing?
Regular Zooms, but we also know that there's so much more that can happen when we're together physically. So the Zoom stuff is more admin, and if we have to nut something out, we'll do it on Zoom. But we're so much more efficient in completing things with when we're in person. Yeah, it's crazy.
I want to talk a bit about Hota Miro. I imagine there are some real pragmatic considerations at play when you're working at that scale. Who's climbing ladders and risking their life and not experiencing vertigo and getting that stuff on, up so high? And
for Hota Miro, we had two really great installers, Jay and Chris, that work at the Dunedin Public Art Gallery, and they were, like, we've worked with a lot of different galleries and installers from biennales and triennales, and they were so great to work with because they were the ones up the scaffold and up the ladders drilling over 500 holes, 5,000 holes, and hammering the nails in. And so not only were they doing that physical work, but they were really good at seeking our advice on what we wanted, and they were really great at listening to us. And, you know, often as women in different gallery and institutions, that's not necessarily always the case, so they were really, really good. In the past, we have gone up the scaffold and up the cherry pickers, but it was nice to have these two really great people on our team. Yeah.
Yeah. The piece itself speaks to, well, I described it as a giant korowai, and I think my understanding of the piece is that the four winds are captured in that piece. Can you give that deeper meaning to that piece beyond what I've seen?
I think that's a really great initial interpretation of it. It definitely is a kākahu kind of hanging in space on the wall, a really large kahurangi. But Hota Miro looks at the narrative of Huru Te Arangi, which is she was an atu of the wind, and her four children, Toko Huru Nuku, Toko Huru Rangi, Toko Huru Mawake, and Toko Huru Atia. And they were placed as pillars between Rangi Nui and Papatua Nuku to hold them apart. The work looks at how the wind could be a pillar holding something of that force. And there's four different kind of embellishments or whakarake on the wall, and each of those represent one of those winds. And the connection between kākahu and this narrative is we've always really wanted to look at different whakarake of kākahu, or different huka huka, and they interact with the wind. So when a wearer wears a kākahu, it's the huka huka that flutter in the wind and move with the wearer. So that was the connection between the narrative and the physical objects.
Wow, thank you. Kākahu is a pretty strong theme throughout your work, or when I've looked at it online and such, I've seen that you're adorning spaces, you're adding a beautiful layer of meaning to whatever space Mataho Collective goes through. Where did that sense of needing to adorn a space come from within the group?
Well, a lot of these techniques that we use are kind of done at a scale for our human body to be worn. And so something we were really interested in exploring was just how we can upscale that to more of an industrial size. So going from a kind of domestic kind of focus of that's kind of traditionally sort of done by women to industrial sizes, which are kind of generally mostly done by men at this moment and historically. So yeah, that's where that comes from.
Tell me a little bit about the materials you are incorporating. We touched on it earlier. What is the intent of incorporating those working class materials into your pieces?
I would say it's about access. And so it would be about the communities that we come from, people being able to go into these institutions and galleries that they might not normally go into and be able to recognise a material and have a point of access into the artwork. So for Hotamiro, we used fencing insulators that carry the number 8 wire. And it's not initially recognisable to begin with, but once you see it, you can see it's all over the whole wall. And so that's something that is quite a common, recognisable, everyday material that we've then utilised to portray the narrative that we want to.
Yeah, and I guess just an observation for me is that when I see this stuff in these kind of hallowed institutions like the DPAG, I'm really pleasantly surprised to see materials that fall outside of that expensive, inaccessible kind of paradigm that you're so used to seeing things in gold gilded frames and everything looks like money.
Yeah.
And it feels like you need a lot of money to be part of that universe.
Right, yeah,
and so just want to congratulate you on blitzing that paradigm apart while still presenting works which are incredibly beautiful.
Yeah, thanks.
Thinking about another important part of this work is it explores that intersection between customary Māori fibre, which is buka and harakeke, and then the introduction of wool into kākahu Māori, and then that brings the connection of the fencing, the wool industry, farming and its impact on the land and how loss of land, and the work kind of goes somewhere else as well in terms of bringing to the forefront conversations around the impact of colonisation on our practices. But also we've always loved kākahu which incorporated wool in them, and for many years we've discussed is this the time that we could incorporate wool into our work? We've pored over kākahu in museum collections around the world and here in Aotearoa that incorporate wool, pāhekeheke stitches or ngore, which is like small pom-pom forms. And so it was really exciting to be able to use them in this project and to use wool alongside muka and the techniques of pō kinikini and karure, huka huka, and bring it all together into something really special.
This is meant in the most complimentary way. There's a kind of punk nature to what you're doing that I really respect. It's moving things forward. It feels progressive to me, and it feels challenging. It feels like all the things good art is kind of meant to do.
I think also that giving us a chance to explore some customary processes is really exciting for us. It's so magical watching mukha be extracted from harakeke. It's so romantic. And then for us to be able to incorporate that into this work has been really fun. And we each spent time in our own regions at home preparing the fibres and brought them here and put it all together. And there was some quality control, but also you can see many different styles and hands in the ways that the karure have been twined or middled. And it's quite nice to also see those little differences within the fibre work as well.
So you've all got access to paharakeke and things like that, no doubt.
We found them, and in each of our different rohe, I think now, I mean, it's such a massive learning curve, finding the right mukha plants and then extracting them, and then the weather and the right day and the humidity and whether the sun's shining and all those things. And what I found quite amazing was, you know, we all went to art school and we learnt in these like quite specific institutions, and then with these customary Māori practices, we've kind of picked them up from different people and we've learnt along the way, which I think has been really fun. And it's that kind of learning that it's really like self-directed and exciting because you're leading it yourself, and so you're asking different people or you're testing out and practicing, and you know, we're showing each other. And yeah, so we have these kind of very specific well-practiced techniques. That is just one example of the many techniques that are involved in cloak making or kete making and lots of different customary Māori practices.
Middle Earth or Narnia?
Narnia.
Wow, okay. Wasn't expecting that,
actually. Yeah, I got a lamppost tattoo.
Oh, okay.
There we go.
I'm at Radio 1 91 FM talking to Adelaide Dunn, sound engineer, recording artist, producer. Lots of things, really, in your back pocket.
Yeah.
You've been doing this music thing for a while now. I believe you started taking formal lessons when you were just 4 years old or something, right? Classically trained.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so there was a singing teacher at my church, and basically, if we rewind all the way back to when I don't even remember, apparently before I could talk, and I didn't talk for a very long time, I used to hum. And there was a case, apparently, of me crawling around as a little baby at about 8 months old, humming Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star in perfect tune. And like a family friend's son pointed out, I'm pretty sure that kid is singing in perfect tune.
Wow.
And I just kind of stemmed from there. I just always hummed and was always singing. And then, yeah, absolutely, when I found out there was a singing teacher at my church, I begged from about the age of three.
Do you believe in like musical gifts versus that kind of hard graft thing, or a bit of both?
I think a bit of both.
Yeah.
I definitely think a bit of both. I definitely think natural talent can take you a long way. You sometimes forget when you've done the 10,000 hours or how many hours it is, just how much work you've put into it.
Mm.
Yeah. So I would say it's definitely a mixture.
I also remember you mentioning to me that you experienced a phenomenon, synesthesia.
Yeah.
Which is, my understanding of it, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is the blending of sensory perception. So people might be able to taste words, or in your case, I believe, colours associate themselves with sounds. Is that,
fair summation? That is a fair summation. Yeah. Yeah, I've had that as well my whole life. It's, yeah.
Is it a blessing or a curse or a bit of both?
It's a bit of both. I find it can be, because I also have in general a lot of sensory processing, whatever you would call that, gifts. blessings, curses. Sometimes it can be incredibly overwhelming. But learning more and more, I've learned to sort of tune it out. But then it's definitely something wonderful to tap into, to be able to see colours and pull them into whatever music I'm making.
You studied music at the University of Otago.
I did.
And you're now working there, I believe, as yeah. well as working at Radio 1 91 FM. The kaupapa of Radio 1 and School of Performing Arts, from what I can gather, is similar in a lot of ways, where there's the desire to kind of uplift and raise, you know, certainly musical capacity within Otipote. But the feeling is similar as well, where there's a real sense of our job is to support creative practitioners. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Absolutely. I feel that we are definitely like a cradle is the wrong word, but we're like two hands cupped, holding a growing scene and nourishing and nurturing people in Dunedin, Otipote Dunedin, in the scene here. So whether that be our young students, because of course Radio 1 and Te Korokoro Te Tui are part of the University of Otago by various means, and so whether that be supporting our young people here at university or Polytech, but also just in general people, musicians making music here in Dunedin of all ages and generations, from high school all the way up to, you know, everybody. So yeah, definitely in whatever way we do that, with either playing their music out on the radio, having them performances, teaching, educating, looking after our volunteers. So it also covers a bit of journalism as well, not just music, but basically looking after and providing a nice safe space for people to be able to have their interests musically, in the case of Radio 1 as well. Journalistically, yeah.
Wonderful. And I'm sure you've been a really important player in that, in realising that synergistic relationship that should always be happening between something like a student radio station and a university performing arts department.
Yeah.
Good things happening between the two organisations.
Good things are happening. We're just starting up a new sort of series. It's been a bit of an experiment called Live from Te Korokoro, where we have student bands or bands of any stage actually playing sort of back to back, so song for song, a little bit like a Jules Holland kind of, you know, now to the right of me, we have, you know, it's really, really lovely with a presenter and different musicians playing in the studio space at Te Korokoro, and then we're broadcasting that live on Radio 1. So Incredible. That's been quite fun.
Yeah, I love it. And somewhere in between all of this, you still find time to be a musician. I read somewhere you don't play any musical instruments, but I refuse to believe it. So on the record.
I do a little bit. So I tutu. I play around. So piano is probably in synth. And I think, but I play them very much my own style. I did a little bit of piano lessons in high school, but definitely I would say I'm quite a minimalist piano player. I think the way I play the piano and the synth is the way I really approach it from a music production perspective. I'm more there making textures and layers as opposed to a lead instrument.
Tell me a little bit more about your production role. I know you produced Repulsive Woman's Relief.
Yeah, that was really fun.
That won a Tate Award.
It did. It did win
a Tate. So you must be pretty flash.
It was my first production, aside from things that I just messed around with myself in my bedroom at home. So when Millie approached me, and I was sort of in my third year of uni thinking about doing honours, and Millie said, I would like you to produce, I was terrified. Mm. I'd never done anything like that before. And then I realised, I thought, I could incorporate this in with my honours year of studying music production. So I said, would you like it made for free by an honours student as part of an honours project, which I then put a dissertation alongside? It was my first big production I ever worked on, and it's still, I'm so proud of it. After that, I went on to produce an album for Neve Strang, and then I've dabbled in other people's work. The most recent sort of thing I've done aside from things for myself, would be Keir Wallace.
Wow.
And they're an incredible musician as well. I'm really lucky to have been very, you know, because I work in music production in my day-to-day job, doing music production outside of my job now is, it takes a lot of energy. So I really pick the projects I work on. So I'm very lucky to have worked with people like Neve and Millie and Kira.
Are you still making music yourself?
I am. Yeah, I'm very much, it's very much in the nothing released or no shows or anything, but I've been working on two projects. One is called Lost Found, which is with my beloved partner Andrew and our dear friends Dave and Irene. We've been playing in Dave and Irene's spare room for a year and a half. We've just been jamming. Yeah. It's all improvised, very ambient, post-noise, jazz, improvised bits. We play once or twice a week, and we've done some recordings with Nick Rowan down at Southlink, and that's been really fun. And we're just kind of Miles Davis style working through those improvised jams and cutting them together into some kind of album. And then I'm also with Andrew, we've been working on an ambient project.
You could change just one thing about the music industry in its current state. What do you think that would be?
Oh my gosh.
Horrible question.
Yeah, well, I literally did my dissertation on how gender and power affect, like, gender diverse people and yeah, femmes entering the music production industry. So definitely there was a very alarming statistic that came out that there was only 5% of people in music production were not men. So always want to change upping that statistic, getting more and more people of all diversity into music production for sure in the industry. Can I have two things?
Yeah, let's go.
The other one is a classic one, which is for Dunedin, and that is more practice space.
Tautoko.
Yeah.
Adelaide, thank you so much for your time.
Beautiful.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.